Mogcast, a fortnightly conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg about the topics of the day.
Hello, and welcome to this, the 55th episode of our regular Mogcast. I'm Henry Hill, the news editor of Conservative Home, and not seated opposite me, because we're all being very socially responsible, but visible on my screen is Jacob Rees-Mogg, the House of Commons. How are you, Jacob?
Extremely well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right. As about thoroughly sick of lockdown, as everybody is, hanging off the Prime Minister's words this afternoon as he sets out what we all hope, I think, is the path back to normality, which I have some questions on, as you might expect.
I thought you might. I'm quite good at guessing some of all of them, but one or two.
Absolutely. I'll try. Maybe there'll be time for tripping you up later, but I think this will be a very well-signalled and telegraphed series of questions. So, the Prime Minister finished speaking a little while ago. One thing that sort of leapt out at me straight away is the fact that there were lots of dates. You know, one of the things that he said earlier on is that he was going to be led by data, not dates. And yet here we have a very date-heavy schedule for the easing of restrictions. Everything seems to have a calendar date attached to it. Is that a change in approach from the Prime Minister, or why do you think he's chosen to go for this particular strategy?
No, you actually asked exactly the question that I raised at a briefing earlier on today that I had, because it seemed to me the fundamental point, really, that we've got this timeline set out, but we're dependent on data. And the answer is that it simply takes a predictable amount of time for the data to become available and to be analysed to provide for the opening up, so that these are the earliest points at which the information will be available on which to base the decision to open up, and then to give people notice so that they can be ready to open up on the potential date. And these are, of course, all could slip, because if the data are less good than hoped for, it may not be as good as this, but this is the hoped-for timeline.
Okay, and do you personally think that the government should have is right, or do you think there should maybe have been some wriggle room if the government keeps, you know, smashing these targets as it seems to be doing? Do you think there should have been some wriggle room for moving things forward if things were going well?
Well, I mean, inevitably, governments always have within them a degree of flexibility, but I think the logic behind the timetable is impeccable, that you want to make sure that the number of people who are seriously ill, who need hospitalization, and so on, is kept to a minimum, that the rollout of the vaccine goes hand in glove with the opening up. And the modelling that has been done so far indicates that this timeline would allow the opening up to be done in a way that it won't have to be reversed. And we will be ahead of almost every other country in the world. I mean, Israel's ahead of us, but of our direct competitors, of the G7, of major European nations, we'll be very much ahead of anybody else. So I don't think we should be too pessimistic about the timeline that's been opened up before us.
Okay, and to dig a little deeper into the logic, one thing that I've seen sort of being bandied about on Twitter, especially, is that this idea that it takes 4 weeks before we can know if a given measure is working, that wasn't the case the other side of Christmas when we were amping up restrictions. You know, we'd introduce one set of restrictions, and then ministers and public health officials were very quick to say that actually that wasn't working, and we needed to go either up a tier or into lockdown, or whatever else. Why do you think that sort of there's two different metrics, one for going up the ladder and one for coming down?
Well, I'm afraid I think that's obvious, that when you fall over and break your leg, you've done it in an instant. When you're in plaster and the leg is mending, that takes a few weeks. And we're in the mending stage rather than the breaking of the leg stage. And I just think that's inevitable. When you see the figures getting out of control, you obviously have to react quickly to do something about it. When you're seeing the figures come back under control, you have to be sure that that isn't just a blip, that it is a trend. That must be the logical way to proceed.
I'm not entirely sure that because obviously if you're reacting to numbers, but you know there's a 4-week delay, it does seem potentially, and I'm not a lockdown skeptic myself, but I can see why people might be arguing, is it precipitate to, right, we know that there's a 4-week delay, the numbers are going up, so we introduce this restriction. And then before we've had time to see if it works, according to this official timeline on the data, which I do agree is the correct timeline with regards to how long it takes, we then need to bring in more. So I think that's all. I'll leave it there because we've got your
okay,
answer.
I'm going to slightly disagree with you because I think they knew that they needed to adopt very tough restrictions to have any effect, that it had already become clear from the earlier experience that light restrictions weren't having the desired effect because of the level of transmission that was taking place, and they'd seen in other parts of the world and indeed in regions or localities within the UK that if you didn't act swiftly, they rose exponentially, and that's the very nature. I mean, it's basically compound interest, isn't it? The R rate is an expression of compound interest.
I see. So in fact, if we're looking back at the previous sort of slight slaloming between different things and the late reverse ferreton Christmas, that might not necessarily be because the data wasn't there, but because maybe the Prime Minister was reluctant to act on it with regards to, for example, curtailing Christmas when he knew everyone had been looking forward to it. That might be the source of the discrepancy. Now, one thing that did leap out at me from the Prime Minister's timeline was there was mention of a renewal of international travel. Now, I know that will be a huge relief, not only to people who want to go on holiday, but also to many millions of people who have family members overseas. You know, my little brother moved to New Zealand, I hope not permanently, in 2019, and for obvious reasons hasn't been able to come back since. But are you concerned that this might lead to the importation of new strains? Because one of the things that has been that certain people have consistently criticised the government for is that it has been reluctant to do what other countries such as New Zealand have done and, quote unquote, shut the borders, really crack down on international travel so that you can focus on driving down COVID levels at home and reopening as fast and fully as possible. Is a return to international travel in May, when we're hoping to be fully unlocked potentially by June, is that precipitate or is that defensible?
Well, one of the caveats to the plan is that our assessment of the risk is not fundamentally changed by new variants of concern. So that if there are new variants, this roadmap will not be followed. It will be adjusted. But I think it is important that we try and get back to as normal as possible, that ultimately the country, the world, will have to live with COVID, that we therefore need to take all the precautions that we can. We need to continue to roll out the vaccination program, but that once the majority of the country is vaccinated, yes, of course, there's a risk if a variant is one that the vaccines don't work over, but we do ultimately have to get back to a global world, that the UK is a pivotal player in this, and we're not New Zealand. We're never going to be New Zealand. That the connections that you mentioned of families living abroad, and that applies to New Zealand, but it's 3 million, 4 million people rather than 60, 65 million people. So it's a very different situation. And our economic prosperity depends on being open to the world.
Okay. And so one question, I think, which relates more specifically to your role as leader of the House, is the House of Commons going to vote on this new plan? And if it isn't, why isn't it?
Oh, yes, of course it is. I mean, the new plan meets the requirement for measures of national significance, and there will inevitably be a vote on this. The current regulations expire on the 31st of March, and there will have to be a vote on the new proposals before the 31st of March.
Lovely, thank you. And so I think one last question on vaccines specifically, because there's the... There were reports, obviously, from anonymous government spokespeople, which are never helpful, about the idea that we can't vaccinate our way out of this, quote unquote, because there will be, they predict, a relatively high number of refuseniks who refuse to get vaccinated. Now, what do you think that the government should do about this? Because obviously there is a danger that if there are a large number of people who refuse the vaccine, then we will reach the end of the voluntary vaccination program with a substantial minority of the population unprotected, and that reopening would put them at risk. But obviously the flip side is that if we can't keep lockdown forever if people aren't going to be accepting the vaccination. Does the government, do you think, have a plan for this? Is there a plan to mitigate it? Or what's the thinking on that question?
Well, I think the figures so far are absolutely remarkable. and we should take great deal of confidence from that. I think 96% of people between 75 and 79 have taken up the vaccine. And this level of take-up is absolutely superb and should be encouraged. So the marginal refuseniks are not at the moment significant in the groups that have been eligible. And that's really exciting and important because I think people recognize the seriousness of it and recognize that it is so strongly in their interests as well as in the interests of the community to be vaccinated. So what you're quoting may be a rather gloomy early assessment, and things have turned out considerably better with the desire for the vaccine being greater than was perhaps anticipated. And of course, with whatever it is now, 17, probably by the time this is broadcast, 18 million people having been vaccinated, we now have even more evidence about its enormously safe nature. And this is really, really important because the newspapers would have reported with glee if there had been problems. And here we are, and there haven't been. It's been a really successful rollout of a safe vaccine. And people should be very reassured by that. And I think that's why there's been such a high take-up level.
Well, fingers crossed. I mean, I think we'd all want to emphasize to our listeners that the vaccine is safe. And, you know, I remember the very first time I ever had the privilege of interviewing you on this show, I questioned you about nightclubs. And today, for the first time, we heard a potential date for nightclubs reopening on the 21st of June. So this has been the best day of 2021 so far for me by a country mile. I don't suppose I'll be able to tempt you out, but nonetheless.
It may make more difference to your lifestyle than to mine, but I'm reassured that the tickets I have bought to go to Lord's Cricket Ground later in the year have not been bought in vain.
There we go, to each his own. Returning to the question of parliamentary procedure again, Karen Bradley, on the day that we're recording this, has published a piece on Conservative Home in which she calls for the resumption of Westminster Hall debates, which apparently have not been permitted under the regulations that have been put in place for the operation of Parliament in a COVID secure way. I don't know if you've read it, but do you have a view on when Westminster Hall debates might be able to return?
Yes, I do. I think I ought to tell the Chamber, though, even before I tell Conservative Home listeners. I tell Westminster Hall that I was the most reluctant person to close Westminster Hall. I didn't think that it was a particularly undue risk, and I think it's important that governments are scrutinised. I think it's good for government, and I think it's the duty of parliamentarians. However, I received representations across the political parties that we should close Westminster Hall in January. So we responded to demand from the people who should have been scrutinising us to close Westminster Hall. And the issue now is that to bring it back requires more people to come into work. The staff of the House of Commons rather than members particularly. And I wanted to hear clearly from people like Karen that she was happy for members of staff to come back. And I'm delighted that the Procedure Committee, the Petitions Committee, the Backbench Business Committee and the opposition do think that is a proportionate risk, because that's always been my view.
And what do you make of her broader criticism that Parliament has had too little say in the setting of its arrangements, and that maybe the government has had too tight a grip? I don't expect you to agree with it, but what would your response be to people who level that criticism?
Well, everything that's been done has been subject to votes in Parliament, so I don't think the criticism is right. And the Procedure Committee has issued reports, and many of the recommendations of the Procedure Committee have been taken on board. Parliament cannot change its procedures on the whim of the government. It requires a vote on the floor of the House, and those votes have taken place.
Okay. Now, I'm going to talk to you about something else, but just a couple more things on COVID-19 while we're here. The Prime Minister today said the government would continue to do whatever it takes to keep the economy going and support businesses whilst we're under lockdown restrictions. But there's growing concern and divisions inside the Conservative family about how that's going to be paid for. You've got people who think that we shouldn't really worry about it, that, you know, interest rates are low and we can keep borrowing. But you've got other people who think that the Chancellor is going to lead with some tax rises in the budget and going to be more worried about paying this back. Do you expect there to be tax rises in the budget, and would you support them?
You know I can't predict what the Chancellor's going to say a few days before the budget. But I can remind you of the Conservative Party's manifesto commitments, which are government policy, which will there'll be no increases in income tax, VAT, or national insurance. And that was the manifesto on which we stood. That is the policy of Her Majesty's government. And that has not been changed.
Do you think it will make the case for fiscal conservatism harder in future if the government, and I'm not, this is not a prediction about what the government's going to do in the next few days, but assuming that the government does continue this huge program of public expenditure without retrenchment, do you think that that will make the case for fiscally responsible conservatism harder to make when we're on the other side of the crisis, sort of in the 2020s and beyond?
No, I don't. I think you need to look back over history at the various responses to the occasions when government debt has exploded. So if you look at the response to the Napoleonic Wars and the response to the First World War, the deflationary approach taken immediately after both of those led to some pretty serious economic problems. And I think if you want to pick a figure, you would choose Keynes, because Keynesianism got a bad name in the post-Second World War period for his solutions being applied to entirely different problems. But if you think about when he was writing in response to the deflationary measures taken after the First World War, when the effort to get back into the gold standard, to rebalance the books, was taken precipitately, and the economy wasn't given a chance to adjust. And exactly the same happens after the Napoleonic Wars. You have a period of very sharp deflation, and indeed you have agricultural unrest because of this deflation. And that doesn't mean that the rest of the Victorian period, actually Napoleonic Wars pre-Victorian, obviously, but the Victorian period didn't take very seriously fiscal rectitude. And likewise, that we haven't taken fiscal rectitude seriously since the 1920s, in fits and starts at any rate. So I think recognizing that a serious economic problem caused by a one-off event, even if that one-off event lasts, in the case of the Napoleonic Wars, for over 20 years, the First World War obviously 4 years, is allowed to have a long-term solution rather than a short-term solution, seems to me to be good economics and based on our nation's history.
Okay, fair enough. Now, it would... it wouldn't be me if I didn't quiz you on the union. So
no, I'm so glad you do. I always like talking about the union.
Excellent. As a self-confessed unionist, does it concern you to see the extraordinary levels of churn and chaos that we've witnessed in the union unit over the last couple of weeks?
I never get too excited about little local difficulties of that kind. I think what matters is the Prime Minister's commitment to the union and the Conservative Party's commitment to the union and the Conservative and Unionist Party, as we have been now for over 100 years. And I think that's what really matters. What Dylan's current views on the union are, I'm not entirely clear of, though I, for the record, I view myself as a friend of Dylan's. I think he's absolutely splendid and delightful. Dog with a lively demeanour, and I think he's a committed unionist too.
Well, obviously, I will steer clear of the sort of personal dimension, because I recall that just by coincidence, the last time I spoke to you on this programme, we crossed swords over that to some extent. But there is, a deeper question than the personnel stuff, which is that there does appear to be a genuine division inside the government as to how best to approach the question of the union. The appointment of the new union unit leader was not just about personnel, but it was also about taking a much more aggressive, apparently, more aggressive approach to the SNP, the sort of thing that we've seen embodied with the UKIM bill, which creates new powers for the British government to spend in devolved areas, which has upset a lot of the usual suspects. And, you know, that's viewed as being countered by a tendency that's more conciliatory, that's behind, say, proposals to give Nicola Sturgeon the right to attend cabinet in certain circumstances. So do you think, I know there's a tendency to always underplay personnel, and journalists like me can overstate their importance for sure, but do you nonetheless think that there is an important decision to be made by the government as to what union strategy it's going to take, and that there are signs that it has not yet made up its mind as to which one it's going to choose?
I think the government is pretty clear on where it stands in terms of the union. And this is Northern Ireland as well as Scotland. I think Northern Ireland often gets overlooked in the union discussion, that Northern Ireland is part of my country, and we should not forget that. And we shouldn't allow a sort of diffidence towards the Republic of Ireland to persuade us not to include Northern Ireland. And in union terms, the issues between GB and Northern Ireland that have arisen post the transition period are, I think, more serious than any changes in personnel in Downing Street. And we have to make sure that the fundamentals of the union work, that we work as one country, and that we ensure that government policy, as with the UKIM bill, can apply to the whole of the United Kingdom, and that we can do things that benefit the whole of the United Kingdom. And that is fundamental, and that is what the government is doing. And I'm very enthusiastic that that should happen. But should we, as the Scottish Secretary does effectively, take the fight to the Scottish National Party, or the Scottish Nationalists, as the Prime Minister likes to call them, yes, absolutely we should.
Well, you've very cunningly preempted my pivot, because obviously I wouldn't take over this show and neglect Northern Ireland for a second. So what do you think of the fact that there is now a unionist legal challenge to the Northern Ireland Protocol that is backed by all three of the major unionist parties in the province?
Well, the unionists, if they unite on this, are able to get rid of the protocol. It has to command a majority in the Assembly in, is it 2024? And so this is very important. If the unionist parties are against the protocol, then they will be able to get rid of it if they unite in elections and are able to have a bare majority, because it's not a cross-community vote. Interestingly, it not being a normal assembly vote with requirements for cross-community support was a requirement of the pro-Europeans rather than the Brexiteers in the negotiations. So that's an important caveat. If they turn against the protocol, they will be within their power to get rid of it in not too many years. And that's important. That's very significant and an interesting point for the European Union to bear in mind, because it's got to realise that if it wants the protocol to work, it's got to ensure that the unionists remain on side with it. And I think it's more to them than it is to us, because don't forget, it's the European Union who said no hard border, no hard border, no hard border, and then implemented a hard border when it felt like it. That's fundamental, that they played ducks and drakes with Article 16, and the unionists have noted that.
Now, I think that one of the issues that the unionists have raised in their legal challenge is the fact that the Secretary of State did in fact change it so that it wasn't a cross-community vote, which they object to. And Lord Trimble, David Trimble, who won the Nobel Prize for his part in bringing unionism to the table in the first place, has said that's part of the reason that he thinks that the protocol tears up the Belfast Agreement. Now, I'm going to get into the weeds just a little while I've got you. The unionist legal challenge is based on this theory that there are certain statutes called constitutional statutes which have this sort of special status and can't be overturned in the ordinary process through implied repeal and the rest of it. Do you, as a constitutionalist who has another very interesting podcast on the Constitution and Westminster, do you have a view on the theory of constitutional statutes that underpins their case?
Well, it's a very modern theory. It's a theory that was developed really in relation to the 1972 European Communities Act and was used to strike down primary legislation that contradicted that. So the Metric Martyrs case, it struck down the Weights and Measures Act to make it illegal to use imperial measures, even though a UK Act of Parliament said it was perfectly legal when European Union law said it wasn't. And it created the status of constitutional act that overrode statutes that would normally, by the principle of implied repeal, the later statute would have held, and that you had to have an explicit repeal. It's a very interesting constitutional argument. Whether it applies now we've left the European Union is a moot point, because it's hard to see what its need is anymore. That, you see, the European Communities Act made constitutional statutes important both in terms of the 1972 Act, but also in terms of our own constitution in relation to the European Union, particularly looking at what the German Constitutional Court was ruling about how the German constitution ultimately overrode its agreements at the European level. And our courts, including, I think, there was a very interesting note in a judgment a few years ago questioning some absolute rights that we might think that we had and the ability of the EU to override them. It may, I can't remember the precise case, but this was evolving because of the tension between EU law and UK domestic law. That tension having been removed, I'm more probably Dicean in my understanding of legislation, and that the next Act of Parliament outrides the previous Act of Parliament, and there's no longer any need for this concept of constitutional statutes.
Fair enough. I'd probably take the same view. I hope the rest of our readers found, listeners found that as interesting as I did. Now, I have one more question before we go. Unionists, whatever, you know, the fact you've mentioned that it was a European demand, and that's correct, but unionists clearly feel that the fact that they don't have the ability to cross, to block the protocol on a cross-community basis is not legitimate. And as there is not currently a unionist majority in Stormont, even though there was one just a few years ago, there is obviously a danger that they won't win a majority at the next elections and therefore will be unable to, as you say, vote down most of the protocol. Do you think that there's a danger in light of those two facts that we might see organised political unionism and the unionist community in Northern Ireland withdraw consent more broadly from the political process in Northern Ireland? You know, there's talk, Peter Robinson, the former First Minister, has already said that unionist parties might collapse the Assembly. We've got reports of the danger of a resurgence of loyalist violence. Is there a risk of a serious breakdown in the post-1998 order in Northern Ireland? And is this something that the government is across?
I think unionist parties, as they're showing with this legal action, have the ability to work together. And if they work together, they may offer a more attractive electoral proposition, in which case, if they can win a majority in Stormont, then they can vote down the protocol. And it would be interesting if the next set of Stormont elections become about the protocol, which is not an impossible thing to imagine. I think, and I would encourage my unionist friends to work through the democratic processes rather than to withdraw consent from them. I think that they are better off winning elections than they are pulling out of structures.
Okay. Well, I think that's been our usual roughly 25 minutes. Thank you very much for giving me your time once again. It's been a very stimulating and illuminating discussion, at least for me, and our listeners tend to agree. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly been enjoyable for me. It's always a great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No problem. And hopefully next time we'll be able to do it in person, because it's always got that certain something. And I'm sick to death of Zoom, as I'm sure you are. Jacob Rees-Mogg, thank you very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
The Moggcast. A fortnightly conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg about the topics of the day.